Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Medicinal Herbs Podcast from Holistic Matters. My name is Dr. Dana Parent, a naturopathic doctor and your new host for the show. Here at Holistic Matters, we're excited to continue bringing you insights from expert herbalists on the latest in botanical medicine. This week, we're talking with Lawrence Katsaras, who is a naturopath, herbalist, and acupuncturist for nearly 20 years. He's also head of education at Integria Healthcare, and he's been working as an educator in functional medicine in Australia and New Zealand for the past 15 years. Today, we'll be talking about cardiometabolic health. Lawrence, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show, Dana.
It's great to be here. So, Lawrence, can you get us started by talking about cardiometabolic health and specifically metabolic syndrome? I think this is a term that a lot of practitioners may hear but don't fully understand. So what is metabolic syndrome and what does this mean for us living here in the United States?
Yeah, it's a great place to start. I mean, it is a very pertinent problem for us as practitioners because when we look at the statistics, we see that unfortunately, 25% of adults in the United States suffer from metabolic syndrome. Now, as you're saying, like, what is that? Metabolic syndrome is a cluster of different disorders. So it's particularly three out of four particular cardiovascular risk disorders. Now, what they are specifically is someone will have abdominal obesity. They may have hyperglycemia, so raised fasting blood glucose levels. They may have hypertension, so raised blood pressure, or they may have dyslipidemia or raised triglyceride levels. Now, out of those four criteria, someone is diagnosed with metabolic syndrome when they have three of the four. So someone may have abdominal obesity, they may have hyperglycemia, and they may have hypertension. And that, as presentations of those own conditions or disorders, will collectively mean that someone's defined as having metabolic syndrome. But it's probably also worth just pointing out, what do we mean when we say abdominal obesity, or what do we mean when we say like dysglycemia or hyperglycemia? Because there's particular categories. And one thing that's probably very important because it's something that we can do at home is looking at our waist circumference. So abdominal obesity specifically is defined as a male who has a waist circumference of 40 inches or more, or a female who has a waist circumference of 35 inches or more. Hyperglycemia, for instance, is looking at someone's fasting blood glucose levels. So what's the blood glucose levels in the morning? And if they are equal to or above 100 milligrams per deciliter, then that would mean that someone has hyperglycemia. If they have hypertension, it's defined as having a systolic blood pressure as 130 millimoles or higher, or a diastolic blood pressure as 85 millimoles or higher. And then dyslipidemia is defined as someone having HDL cholesterol as less than 40 milligrams per deciliter in men, or less than 50 milligrams per deciliter in women, and triglycerides as 150 milligrams per deciliter or higher. Now, one thing also I will just point out is that some people may not fit that specific criteria because they may be on medications for that, and in which case that means that they're fitting that criteria. So, for instance, a person may have be taking statin medications for their cholesterol levels. So their cholesterol levels should be improved. So they may not fit that range that I just listed out, but the sheer fact of taking medications for one of those conditions means that they basically fit that particular criteria. So that's the collection of conditions and physiological processes that are going on. When someone fits that, they're defined as having metabolic syndrome. And the reason why that's of concern for us all is because that sets up processes that are contributing to other complications as well. So that's worsening heart disease, which is the number one leading cause of death in the United States. That's also contributes to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. It contributes to other disorders as well. And so collectively, you sort of see metabolic syndrome as an umbrella term of a bunch of different disorders that are going on, and they help increase someone's risk of cardiovascular disease.
And that's really interesting, you know, and as a practitioner, you know, of course, these make sense, you know, this hyperglycemia, this elevated fasting blood glucose, you know, that's something I'll measure routinely on blood work, same with dyslipidemia. And then, you know, whenever a patient comes into my office, of course, I am, you know, looking at their blood pressure as well. But, you know, this one of abdominal obesity, you know, that one really gets me. Why is that important specifically?
Such a good question, Nana. It is interesting because not all fat is the same, is it? Like, we understand that depending on where the fat is located can increase the risk of to our health from that particular fat consequences. So specifically, the reason why we're measuring someone's waist circumference and looking at that abdominal obesity, or sometimes it'll be referred to as central obesity, is because that's known as visceral adipose tissue, or sometimes you'll see it in the literature as VAT for short, V-A-T. Now, the problem with VAT is that because it's tightly packed around our visceral organs, it gets a high amount of blood flow. And this fat is actually very different visually and from like a palpation sense compared to subcutaneous fat. So that fat that's around that abdomen, we think about that large belly. We know that if the patient or as the doctor, we try to palpate that, it's harder, isn't it? And that's because it's more densely packed around the visceral organs and it's different to that fat that we can grab, which is subcutaneous fat. Now, the problem with the visceral adipose tissue, or that central fat, is that it actually is metabolically active. And what I mean by that is that it actually secretes metabolic factors such as inflammatory cytokines like interleukin-6, and it also secretes free fatty acids. So these fat cells are actually overpacked with free fatty acids, and this then leaches out those free fatty acids. Those free fatty acids then, because of the high abundant of blood flow and where they are, those free fatty acids are then transported from that fat mass through to the liver, and then they accumulate within the liver and impair the liver's insulin sensitivity. This then starts to set up problems with insulin resistance and starts to set up the downstream effects or the early effects for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. This then, these free fatty acids being secreted by that visceral adipose fat or that abdominal obesity, starts to change our cholesterol profile. And that's exactly why we see raised triglyceride levels and lowered HDL levels, is because of these high amounts of circulating free fatty acids. So ultimately, it's that abdominal obesity is a problem because it is metabolically active tissue that produces inflammation, it produces free fatty acids, which then impair our liver's insulin sensitivity, changes our cholesterol profile, and basically sets up the process for the whole metabolic syndrome.
Well, that's so interesting. You know, a lot of times I don't think people know that there's different types of fat and kind of the activity, you know, the metabolic activity can be changed depending on the type of fat we're talking about. All right. And then changing gears here for a moment, I know that you're aware of the emerging research, you know, on the connection between the gut microbiome and metabolic health. And there's just some really cool research happening out there these days. I was just actually reading a study the other day about this proposed link between gut health and exercise motivation. And it's just fascinating. So would you mind talking to us about how the microbes in our digestive system can influence things like our metabolism and our weight?
It is fascinating, isn't it? The research that's coming out on the microbiome constantly, I think, reshapes our understanding of just how far-reaching those microbes within our digestive system are impacting our health. And like you've indicated, there's maybe connections there where we wouldn't even necessarily think about. So while we're talking about the abdomen and we're talking about, you know, waste accumulation there, the next region is, let's go inside for sure. What's happening within those bugs that could influence why someone might be accumulating that weight to begin with? And it's surprising for some to learn that those microbes and the function and the composition of those microbes within our digestive system actually have a huge impact on regulating our weight, regulating our inflammatory profile, regulating someone's food consumption, like how satiated or how hungry they may end up being. So what ends up happening is that we get this bit of a self-perpetuating cycle in some ways. So basically, if we start from the digestive system and the microbiome, we see that the composition and function of those microbes will regulate the production of metabolites such as short-chain fatty acids. It will regulate the secretion of hormones from the intestine known as enteroendocrine hormones. The microbes will also regulate the structural integrity of our digestive tract or of our gut lining. So collectively, what we start to see is that these microbes can, as a big broad picture, could influence our metabolism, which I'll go into in a second with the enteroendocrine hormones, but it can influence our satiation and also our inflammation. Because if we have dysfunctional microbiome, so if we've got a high amount of dysbiotic bacteria producing low levels of short-chain fatty acids, then what ends up happening is we're not producing a good level of, like, you know, primary short-chain fatty acid like butyrate, which is helping to produce mucus. And that mucus layer is a structural component of the digestive system. If we have dysbiotic bacteria, we also then produce more inflammatory cytokines. Those then start to break down the tight junctions and the integrity of our digestive tract. Collectively, essentially, we end up with what we all know as kind of like leaky gut, this concept of high amounts of translocation from the digestive system into systemic circulation. Now, that's a problem because inflammation impairs our glucose homeostasis. Inflammation can help drive obesity. So that's one component that can start to have a metabolic effect. But it gets a little bit more sophisticated when we start to look at the fact that these microbes, through producing, you know, metabolites like short-chain fatty acids and these enteroendocrine hormones, they start to change our secretion of hormones like glucagon-like peptide or GLP-1, cholecystokinin, or otherwise known as CCK, or peptide YY, which ultimately these hormones that are produced within our intestine, they influence our glucose homeostasis, they regulate our appetite, they regulate our gut motility, so how quickly things are moving through our digestive system, how quickly we'll empty our stomach. This then impacts our satiety, so then in course, regulating our appetite again. And what we get there is then that may start to send cues back to the brain. So if we break that down for a second, because I've kind of gone through a bit of a complex process, is ultimately the microbes within our digestive system, they'll help to regulate the production of our enteroendocrine hormones. That then will influence someone's glucose metabolism, their insulin sensitivity, and their feeding, their hunger, and the satiety symbols. That then will communicate with the brain. That then would get the individual saying, I'm actually hungry again. Or in a healthy situation, I'm actually quite satiated. Now, obviously, in a dysregulated situation, that person goes, I'm hungry again. They'll then start looking for more food, but they'll also go looking for particular food, like food that's actually quite instantly satisfying, like our simple carbohydrates, our sugars, our fast foods, etc. Now, this is where it turns into a self-perpetuating cycle, is because then that diet, then if we're eating those simple carbohydrates that break down too quickly in our digestive system and they don't reach our large intestine, then they don't actually feed our microbes. And what ends up happening is we end up eating food that doesn't actually support the health and diversity of our gut microbes. That then creates that self-perpetuating cycle. We then start to get dysbiotic bacteria in our microbiome. That then also starts to, you know, create those problems that I talked about. And if we have incorrect bacteria, what's fascinating is that our microbes within our digestive system will influence how much energy we harvest from the particular food that we eat. Meaning that two people can sit down to eat the same meal, but based on the microbes within that individual's digestive system, one person may harvest more energy from that meal. Now, harvesting more energy, if we don't use that energy, it gets stored as energy for the future, known as fat. So we start to see how, based off what's going on from those microbes within our digestive system, our gut microbiome, it will influence our integrity of our gut mucosa, so it could lead to leaky gut. It will affect the metabolites that are produced within our digestive system, like our short-chain fatty acids. They have immunomodulating effects. They have effects on inflammation or modulating inflammation. It will affect our enteroendocrine hormones. That will affect our glucose metabolism, our insulin secretion, how hungry we may be, our digestive motility. And then based off all of that, it can collectively impact the individual's food consumption and how much energy they harvest from food. So it's kind of this complex interplay, which then all, if it's dysfunctional, there's many different ways how it can negatively impact someone's metabolism.
Wow, that is quite a cycle that you just outlined, and you can definitely see where things could go awry. Now, how would someone know if these changes were taking place within their microbiome? You know, do people need to get a stool test or a microbiome test?
It's a really good point, because based off what I just described, we could all start to get a little bit scared about what's going on within our digestive system, right? So there are gut microbiome tests available. Now, the clinical utility of those still have some variation, because we are talking about a huge ecosystem of microbes that are living within our digestive system. And each week, more and more papers are being published about this so that we can understand it a little bit more. So testing for the composition and function of our microbiome can provide us with an understanding of what's going on. But I do think that as practitioners, we need to be careful about how we interpret those and how much weight we put on it. Because years ago, we were thinking if there was this particular bacteria, then it meant this. And now we understand that that's actually not quite true. So what we do understand is that there are certain species of bacteria or microbes that are important for maintaining, in this instance, metabolic health. So we see things such as Akkermansia muciniphilia, where this is shown to be reduced in individuals that are overweight or have cardiometabolic complications. And we see that diversity is really important within our microbiome, because what tends to happen is this term known as functional redundancy, where if there's one bacteria that's not available, there'll be other bacteria that will pick up the job and start doing that. So that's where it's become a little bit more complex about how we understand and interpret microbiome testing. But ultimately, we can use stool testing and microbiome testing as an indication. And we'd be looking, like I specifically like to look at the diversity. So otherwise you'll see this as like the Shannon index. That's always been shown to be a very good marker of a healthy microbiome. So the more diverse bugs that we have or microbes that we have within our gut microbiome, the better health that we're going to be having there. We see particular species where there's indications. So I mentioned like Akkermansia, for instance. We can be looking at some of those as a general indication. But what I actually like to do is be looking at clinical indicators. So what gives us a good indication about what's going on in someone's digestive system is things like asking those good old questions about their stool habits and their stool health and consistency. You know, like the Bristol stool chart is still something that's very much used in my clinic. So that we will talk about the regularity of movements, ease of movements, color, form, consistency, all of those lovely topics that our patients love to talk about. Also then looking at what they're eating, and as you talked about, like what they might be doing. So we see that in terms of there's particular foods that will be helping to feed the diversity of our microbiome, and there's particular lifestyle factors that will help to encourage the health of a healthy microbiome. I'll be doing that through like a clinical assessment. And if I see factors like digestive symptoms such as bloating, chronic constipation, diarrhea, lots of gas, flatulence, if I see poor diet, if I see other lifestyle factors, lack of exercise, etc., then based from that, I'll know that there is likely going to be an effect on the microbiome there.
Yeah, and I love that you pointed that out. You know, from the research, it just seems that there is no one perfect microbiome test. And so we're just constantly, you know, reading the papers and seeing, again, you know, to your point, going back to clinical indicators. So you can kind of put those two together, but there's not one perfect microbiome that your optimal microbiome test that you're trying to achieve.
Definitely. I think that when we discovered the microbiome going back a couple of decades, we were hoping that it could be this same kind of idea as a pill for an ill, you know, that, oh, there must be one bacteria that's missing. And if we can supplement with that, then it will fix everything. But ultimately, we're talking about a very complex living ecosystem within our digestive system. And as you're pointing out, that then means it's the same as how we address the health of ourselves. It's not just one thing. It's that complex interplay of all the factors that keep us healthy as an individual. The same kind of thing with our microbes is that there's a complex interplay of how our physiology actually keeps them healthy. Like, for instance, if you have a high degree of inflammation within your digestive system, that will actually impact the health and the function of your microbes within your gut. So it actually could be you impacting the microbes. Or if you've got a poor diet and you've got a dysfunctional microbiome that could produce inflammation, then that could affect our health. And so there's this bi-directional relationship and that complex interplay between us and them.
Yeah. And speaking of which, you know, now that we've really talked about the issue at hand, you know, what are your recommendations for a diet or herbal, you know, support? You know, I mean, how do we intervene in this cycle that we've been talking about?
So there are particular foods and herbs and spices that we've been able to see, as well as like lifestyle factors, that are really beneficial for improving the health of our microbiome and that will also produce benefits directly to our metabolic health as well. So starting first and foremost is, of course, with diet. Now, we want to be making sure that ourselves and our patients are eating a diet that's high in plant-based fibers. Now, that does not mean that it needs to be a vegetarian diet, but we need to be making sure that we consume good amounts of fiber from plant-based sources, because it's these plant-based fibers that actually will help to feed our microbes most effectively. Those will help to boost our short-chain fatty acids and those other metabolites from the microbiome. Basically, the general recommendation from the literature is that you want to be eating a varied diet of plant-based foods alongside everything else that you're eating. That will produce the greatest amount of diversity. Because if we think about the fact that we're feeding these microbes with the food, if we're always feeding them with the same foods, we don't encourage the greatest amount of diversity, because we will see that some particular fibers or some particular foods, like plant-based foods, may feed some types of microbes, but maybe not others. So a nice varied diet that's high in plant-based fibers. So that's generally where we talked about eating seasonally, and you tend to kind of get that nice variation. We want to then be making sure that we are getting that individual to be doing lifestyle factors. So like movement, and especially leg-based movements, help to increase the diversity. So walking, running, the more we move around and use our feet, the more we help to boost the diversity. That helps because it helps to stimulate motility and gastric secretions, and then that helps with supporting the diversity and health of our microbes. We can talk about other lifestyle factors a little bit later on, but while I'm talking about the specific changes to the environment within the digestive system, that's then when we start to look at specific herbal ingredients that can be used to help stimulate gastric secretions and keep that terrain or that environment of the digestive system healthy. Because ultimately, that microbiome being an ecosystem, there's certain environments that will help that ecosystem remain harmonious and healthy. And there'll be other environments where it would promote dysfunction. So we want to keep that pH and keep those secretions at the right kind of levels. This is then where we come into looking at digestive herbs and bitter herbs, because specifically what these bitter herbs will do is they'll actually increase in cretins. Now, in cretins, where we're looking at intestinal hormones that have beneficial effects. So we start to be looking at those enteroendocrine hormones that I talked about before, like glucagon-like peptide, like cholecystokinin, like peptide YY, etc. So when we use bitter herbs, so specifically herbs such as bitter melon, gentian, feverfew, wormwood, these help stimulate our incretins, and that then produces those benefits that I talked about in terms of the metabolic effects, you know, regulating glucose metabolism, insulin, etc. But they also help to regulate the terrain of our digestive system, keeping the pH and the secretions at the right level to keep our microbiome nice and healthy. So maybe it's worth just chatting about some of the benefits of those particular herbs for a moment. So bitter melon, right? Now, bitter melon is a very fascinating herb because it's actually a herb that's actually been used traditionally within Southeast Asia. Now, it was used traditionally as a food in salads and in stir fries. As the name suggests, it is a bitter herb. And what I find is fascinating about its use traditionally is the fact that it would, like in modern research, we actually start to see that it actually has benefits of just a one-off dose. So when you were to include bitter melon in a food like a salad or a stir fry, what we see is that it actually reduces your glucose after that meal. So that's great when it was being traditionally used in food regularly throughout the days of the week. However, in the West, it's not something that we often would typically include in our standard diet. And because of its bitter flavors, it's something that's maybe not that palatable for a lot of people. But I bring this up because I find it fascinating to see that the therapeutic effects that bitter melon has from just a one-off dose. Now, in studies where they look at using this for someone with more metabolic complications. So, you know, we're talking about metabolic syndrome. You're looking more at using bitter melon as an ongoing herbal supplement. And typically, you know, like studies look at around 2.5 grams a day, equivalency of a dried fruit of bitter melon. Studies have done this for 2 months, and they'll find that that'll reduce fasting blood glucose levels. And they've done this in individuals with pre-diabetic syndrome, so when they've nearly got diabetes but not quite. And we see that it reduces their fasting blood glucose levels by about 5 milligrams per deciliter, which is statistically very significant. Now, one thing that is interesting when we consider bitter melon and its traditional use is that when we have a look at blue zones around the world, which are these zones where people have been found to live past, like a lot of people live past 100, we see that bitter melon is actually regularly consumed in some of these areas. And that sort of points to me some of the indication around the therapeutic efficacy of bitter melon, definitely, but just how profound and important bitter herbs and ingredients are within our diet. So one thing to keep in mind with bitter melon, though, is that the seeds do have some concerns around potential toxicity. So when I'm using a supplement of bitter melon, I'm making sure that it's a de-seeded so that they've removed the seeds from that herb so that there's all the therapeutic benefits of bitter melon, but without the potential consequences of any kind of toxins that shouldn't be in there. Now, another herb that I do love to use for metabolic benefits that has similar benefits, but a little bit more far-reaching is, of course, cinnamon as a nice spice. That's a herb that we can be using, which has been shown in studies to be, again, reducing fasting blood glucose levels. It will reduce blood glucose levels over a 3-month period. It will reduce, so like decreasing glycated hemoglobin. It will reduce waist circumference. It will reduce BMI. Cinnamon has these really broad effects. Essentially, you might say is like anti-diabetic, the literature points towards, anti-hypertensive, so it reduces blood pressure. Reduces inflammation, it's anti-inflammatory, and helps regulate insulin levels as well. So cinnamon typically gets used like therapeutic doses to achieve this in metabolic syndrome is you're looking around about 3 grams a day for sort of 3 to 4 months. And you'll see benefits, of course, before that, but this is, I'm just quoting what the studies have found. And you'll start to see that you'll improve these glucose metabolism in the individual that'll then start to have the flow-on effects to helping to reduce waist circumference and reducing someone's fat mass as well. But again, something to just be aware of if you're using cinnamon, and especially in good doses like that, is you want to be making sure that you're using the right form of cinnamon, because there's different species of cinnamon. And there are concerns, like here in Australia, we have concerns of one of the constituents that can be found in some forms of cinnamon in high levels, which is known as cumarin. Now, cumarin has potential concerns around hepatic toxicity. So if you have too much cumarin, it can cause problems for the liver. However, if you use the right form of cinnamon, the cinnamon verum or true cinnamon, you actually get low levels of cumarin naturally within that cinnamon. So then you get the therapeutic constituents of the cinnamon with lower levels of the cumarin. So I'm always making sure when I'm prescribing cinnamon that I'm using that true cinnamon. And it's something that I'd be encouraging practitioners to be doing, is making sure they're sourcing the right species of the cinnamon there. And then ultimately, you know, I mean, I could talk on and on. There's a variety of different herbs that we can sort of list out, and we can get into those in more detail if you'd like. But as we start to be using these herbs like bitter melon, cinnamon, black cumin is another one that has metabolic effects as well. We can start to be using like berberine-containing herbs. And then we use our bitters like, you know, our gentian, our feverfew, our wormwood. These have direct effects, some of them on the microbiome, some of them on the microbiome and metabolic health, and some of them just directly on metabolic health. So a combination of using those sorts of ingredients, you start to attack what might be going on from a microbiome-driven metabolic disorder and complications, as well as directly addressing the metabolic physiology at hand.
And that's just great information. You know, some of these herbs might be things that we've seen in our spice cabinet, like cinnamon, and then some of them might be some newer herbs that individuals might not use in clinical practice. And so, you know, just kind of getting back and kind of going back to putting this all together, you know, that the research is really showing that there's a complex interplay of physiology to metabolic syndrome. And, you know, again, putting this together, how does really supporting digestive health, diet, the microbiome, everything together, you know, how does that fit into the bigger picture? And are there any last thoughts that you would like to leave us with today?
Such an important point, I think, Dana, is ultimately like, how does all this plug in? It's nice to look at the microcosm of things and say, wow, the microbiome's doing this, and this is what's happening in blood glucose levels, et cetera. But ultimately, when we're working with people, is we need to see, how does that all fit together? And so as we sort of started to touch on, is the gut microbiome, ultimately, if I'm seeing an individual with metabolic syndrome, and I see that they have digestive symptoms, I, you know, through talking to them about their bowel habits and their stool health, we start to identify that that's not ideal, then I'd start to immediately think, okay, we need to look at putting in some of those bitter herbs. We need to be making sure we're addressing diet to be supporting the microbiome health, et cetera. Then the other factors that I'm looking at is, as I indicated, I'll look at what's going on in their lifestyle, making sure that they're, you know, reaching, whether it might be their 10,000 steps a day, or whether they're trying to run or just move their feet, you know, that could even be like dancing, going for walks, walking the dog, etc. Get those feet moving to help support diversity of the microbiome. I'll be looking at putting in herbal ingredients, like I sort of talked about, whether that might be herbs such as philodendron for containing berberine, or black cumin, otherwise known as nigella, for direct metabolic effects, cinnamon. This will directly affect what's going on with the dysfunctions in their metabolic physiology. Then we look at what collectively is going on that could be contributing and driving some of those poor metabolic like health situations in that individual. So I look at sleep. I want to be making sure that individual's getting between, like, ideal amounts of sleep is 7 to 8 hours a night. I'm wanting to be making sure that's good quality sleep as well, so they're reducing their blue light before they go to bed and they're following sleep hygiene practices. If someone doesn't have great sleep, interestingly, we'll see that there'll be a reduction in their diversity of their microbiome. If you get 2 hours less sleep tonight, it's fascinating that tomorrow you'll want to consume 200 more calories at least. And the body will do this to kind of offset the depletion that it has in the lack of rest that it has. That's obviously going to then impact what someone's going to be able to do if they're trying to follow some particular dietary practices. Then specifically, we talked about diet. So making sure there's good amounts of plant-based fibers. You know, sure, adding in meat there is a great idea and really beneficial for a lot of people, but just making sure that they're adding in good amounts of plant-based foods. We want to be trying to, if we can, optimal diet for improving metabolic health is showing that we're not eating 2 hours before bed and that we've got this fasting window of 16 hours. If someone's doing everything really well with their diet and they say to me, Lawrence, how can I take my diet to the next level? You know, I'm still suffering with some weight issues. My metabolic health still isn't great. We sort of see some of those pathology markers there. That's then the kind of icing on the cake, pardon the pun, is looking at like fasting for 16 hours. So that generally looks like most people skipping breakfast and then eating at midday. However, The science shows that best way to do it is you actually want to front load most of your food, and you want to eat most of your food in the morning and then actually taper off your consumption of food and maybe more likely skip dinner if that's feasible for someone. We talked about exercise already. Specifically, if someone's trying to burn off that fat mass that's around that central region, my general recommendation is looking at more high intensity interval training or HIIT training. 20 to 30 minutes of that will actually produce metabolic benefits and is going to help to burn off that abdominal obesity better than something like going for an hour long run. And then we look at other factors like stress, because that will impair someone's insulin signaling, that will raise their inflammation, that will worsen and more likely increase their caloric consumption. And then I'd be looking at other sort of general systemic factors, like if someone's suffering from inflammation, like if they've got osteoarthritis, for instance, that inflammation needs to be factored in and considered. So I think as practitioners, if we go through and work through some of those, making sure we cover the foundations, let's look at diet, let's look at lifestyle, let's look at what else is going on in terms of the foundations of like sleep, when are they eating, what are they eating, are they moving, then also factor in the more complex aspects such as what other physiologies are at play, whether that might be stress, inflammation, what other psychological factors are at play, because there's also like psychosocial implications for impacting how someone's body composition is or the food that they're eating, etc. When we work through and assess those and then just step through piece by piece where someone's at, we can produce really profound results and start walking them back towards health and away from cardiometabolic complications. And then I find that by using those botanical medicines that we've kind of talked about, like your cinnamon, your bitter melon, your philodendron to produce berberine, your bitter herbs like gentian, ginger, feverfew, wormwood, all of these then really give that metabolism and the physiology a kickstart and get it moving in the right direction. And then we combine that with holistic assessment and treatment and the support through diet and lifestyle. And I find that we really start kicking goals, and patients are often surprised at what they can achieve in 2 to 3 months. When you really get all of that, their physiology, their lifestyle, their daily habits all working collectively together, we start reversing those metabolic complications and start to dramatically improve someone's health. And the reason why I think that's so important is that ultimately, that helps give them their life back. They've got better quality of life. They've got more energy. They feel better about themselves. But most importantly, that takes them away, steers them away, and decreases their risk from the number one killer, cardiovascular disease. So really powerful medicine that I think that us as practitioners can support our patients in their health journey.
Wow, this has been just an amazing conversation, and we could talk about cardiometabolic health for another several hours at least, but I just want to thank you so much for joining us today, Lawrence.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this month's episode of the Medicinal Herbs Podcast. For more on medicinal herbs and cardiometabolic health, visit holisticmatters.com. That's holistic with a W.